Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to the SAA Dinner Theater performance of session session number 202. How do you find that? Angling for access. As the screen over here has promised, we will all try to be sharp today. I am Robert Johnson Lally. I'm the archivist of the Archdiocese of Boston, and my remarks will be limited to introductions. I will be introducing the three speakers in order of their appearance, and we hope this will engender a good discussion or at least some good ideas about providing or not providing, as the case may be, access. Access concerns run the gamut from the rather negative implementing and enforcing restrictions on our holdings to the much more positive of providing information on how to find the materials that will assist researchers in their work and everything that falls in between. Most often, access results in a fine balance of the two extremes of openness and restriction. Furthermore, access to denominational archives has unique aspects not always encountered in other types of repositories. What we think of as standard procedures may not be the norm, and identifying and locating records may be a challenge. What don't researchers know about these access issues that they should? The three speakers today will share with you their answers to this question and maybe raise more questions and explain what they do to help researchers navigate the often murky waters of access to denominational religious collections. On my right, Emily Lee Loomis is the archivist and records manager for the Diocese of Baton Rouge. Before working on at the diocese, Lee was a contract researcher, providing research services to authors, historians, lawyers, and genealogists, a motley crew indeed. Lee holds a master's degree in education from the University of New Orleans and currently is enrolled in a PhD program at Louisiana State University. As a researcher, graduate student, and archivist, Lee has had the opportunity to visit many archives and libraries in the United States and France. Having this perspective from both sides of the fence has shaped Lee's views and opinions on research access. Today, in light of these experiences, she will discuss how access policies at the Diocese of Baton Rouge have changed during her tenure there. Jennifer McGillen has been the archivist at the Jewish Historical Society of Metro West in Whippany, New Jersey, since 2004. Before coming to the Historical Society, she was project archivist at the University Archives at Susquehanna University in Selinsgrove, Pennsylvania, which was her first position after graduating from the Archives Program at the University of Pittsburgh in 2003. Today, she will be talking about access to Jewish records in terms of the challenges facing individuals doing local history research. And finally, Mark Thiel is a certified archivist at Marquette University. For the past 20 years, Mark has administered Catholic records collections pertaining to Native Americans, and soon will be completing a two-year, 14-state survey of Catholic records in the West about Native Americans. Previously, he established and directed the archives of the Oglala Lakota College on Pine Ridge Indian Reservation in Kyle, South Dakota. And in 1980-81, he served as the project archivist for Marquette's comparable survey of Catholic records in the Midwest. Today, Mark will discuss the Western and Midwest survey projects as a Marquette model for enhancing research access to religious and ethnic collections that are not fully described online. Lee?
Nobody else wanted to go first. We drew straws, I lost. The Diocese of Baton Rouge has an archives which is both institutional and historical. Those records pertaining to the institution or the business side of the diocese are assessed internally by the administration. Access is governed by canonical as well as civil law. For the purpose of this discussion, I am only going to address access to those historical records of the diocese. Public access to historical records in Catholic dioceses in the United States have changed over the last two decades. Changes have been slow, and the notion of equal access is still not embraced by all dioceses. This paper will discuss the migration in thought and the changes to the access policy of the Diocese of Baton Rouge. I come to the issue of access from both sides of the fence, both as a researcher and an archivist, each of which provides a unique perspective to access issues. By being a researcher first, I have had the opportunity to visit and research in many various types of repositories, state and national archives, courthouses, university libraries and special collections, individual family papers, historical collections, county libraries, national libraries both in the United States and in France, and last but not least, religious collections. We are all familiar with the breakdown of who collects what in the private versus public repositories. Access policies vary with each entity. Courthouses are often interesting, as you never know what you will face. I have dug through boxes on the floor or on the top shelf that the staff either didn't know existed or was unfamiliar with the contents. I have also been given keys to the storage area and told to lock up after I was finished and turn out the lights. This courthouse happens to be in the middle of Louisiana and has some of the earliest records of the state. Researching overseas has its own obstacles, notwithstanding the obvious language barriers. For example, at the Bibliothèque Nationale in Paris, there is the processing procedure that can take several hours. During the process, queuing and paperwork are an art form. And after that, there's the face-to-face interview where you answer everything orally in French of the papers you've just filled out. At the Centre d'Archives d'Outre-mer in Aix-en-Provence, a branch of the archives, the Archives Nationales, which houses the documents that pertain to France's colonies, the procedure is not quite as cumbersome, but the process is much the same. I have not had the opportunity or the guts to venture into the Archives Nationales in Paris, but I have been told by a professor that he would write a letter of recommendation so that the process and the procedure would be less intensive. Internationally, jumping through hoops on the front end gives you access to many documents that we in the United States wouldn't think of opening to the public. I have held documents signed and sealed by Louis XIV and his administrators with my bare hands, no gloves needed. If the paper was stable, I could Xerox it. We wouldn't dream of putting such a document on a copy machine here in the United States, but in France, the documents are open to research. It's not wrong, it's just a different way of thinking about public documents and the right to access those documents. So how did all of this research shape the present access policy at the Diocese of Baton Rouge? Well, I have to tell you of my experience as a researcher at the diocese some 10 years ago. I was doing research for an author who was writing about A.P. Touro, a well-known civil rights attorney in Louisiana, and I was contracted to research the family during the time of slavery, what plantation they belonged to, and if possible, provide an insight into which slave owners fathered the children. After months of researching at the courthouse, I turned to the records of the diocese. I had found the family sacramental records published after 1865, but needed to research the sacramental registers that held the slave baptisms. The archivist at the time charged me $10 per two-hour visit because I was a professional researcher. I learned afterward that she did not like professional researchers and decided that if the researcher was going to make money, so was the diocese. Is this fair access? I certainly don't think so, as it's one of the first things I got rid of when I became the archivist. As a sidebar, the archivist did a great job preserving the older sacramental records, raising money through publishing abstracts in order to pay for the preservation. She died about 8 years ago, and that's when the job became open. I didn't become the archivist right away, but after some persuading by a colleague, I joined the staff as the associate archivist in 2000 and became the archivist in 2003. The access policy of the diocese in 1996, of which I inherited, contained the following. A search of the diocesan historical archives will be made by a qualified staff personnel upon both the request and prepayment of a reasonable fee set by the archivist. The fee may be waived at the discretion of the archivist. The findings of such a search will be certified in writing. Persons wishing to conduct a search in the diocesan archives personally may do so, provided, 1, application is made in writing, accompanied by a letter of introduction and recommendation from their parish priest or other minister. 2, the search is done only with the specific approval of the diocesan chancellor or archivist. 3, the search is made always under the supervision of a staff member by a prearranged appointment during regular business hours. And 4, the person conducting the search agrees beforehand in writing that the search is being conducted for genealogical, historical, or other similar purposes and is not intended for any civil or criminal process. The archivist may set a reasonable fee for such access to the historical archives in individual cases if the scope of the inquiry or a need for an archivist assistance in the task is suggested. That $5 an hour got her to go into the vault, pull the book, and give it to me. I will discuss each of these regulations, the reason why they were originally put together as such, and then what changes were made to formulate the current access requirements. In 1976, the first policies of the diocese were written and promulgated. The language and concepts on that 1996 policy echoes the same regulations as the first policy. Little had changed in 20 years, except for an inflation of fees. We still do not charge for services, but not walking. We do still charge fees for services, but not for walking in the door and using the collection. I want to discuss that first statement at length because it began the process of change. Persons wishing to conduct a search of the diocesan archives personally may do so, provided application is made in writing accompanied by a letter of introduction and recommendation from the parish priest and/or minister. This is actually not an uncommon practice. It is still found in some dioceses. The belief is that if someone is writing a history of a parish, an agency of the diocese, or of the diocese itself, the diocese wants to maintain some control over what is written. This process would also prevent unwarranted research into church history. While this may be a common practice for some, I don't believe that it should be a part of the policy. In reviewing the access policies of several other dioceses, I have also seen a statement that the archives is open to qualified researchers and/or scholars. That first policy of the diocese promulgated in 1976 contained that very sentiment, available to qualified scholars and other persons whose stated reasons for seeking information are judged valid in the opinion of the diocesan archivist or diocesan authorities. My question then is, what is a qualified researcher and what defines a scholar? Does someone need to be working on a master's or a doctorate degree to be considered a scholar, or a professor writing an article or a book? I know for a fact this policy is sometimes used to keep those doing family research or genealogy out of the archives. This is usually justified by a statement that there is not the space nor the staff for such research. I believe that documents open to the public should be just that, open to all of the public, without the caveats of letters of recommendation or level of education. The Boy Scout working on his genealogy merit badge, or the high school student writing a paper on the Bishop Ott Shelter, or someone seeking or searching for a lost ancestor, all have equal access to our archives. There are two key documents that support this concept and that I used for arguing the elimination of that first statement in our guidelines. In 1991, the Association of Catholic Diocesan Archivists adopted guidelines for access to diocesan archives. It stated that there is a concept of equal use and that archival repositories have a duty to be as open as possible to all of their constituencies, regardless of conditions such as race, creed, or professional statute. In 1997, the Pontifical Commission for the Cultural Heritage of the Church wrote a circular letter entitled The Pastoral Function of Church Archives. and Section 4, entitled The Appreciation of the Patrimony of Documents in the Historical Culture and the Mission of the Church, the issues of access are addressed. It's a little bit long, but it is worth reading. Archives, as part of the cultural heritage, should be offered primarily at the service of the community which has produced them. But in time, they assume a universal destination because they become the heritage of all of humanity. The material stored cannot be, in fact, precluded to those who can take advantage of it in order to know more about the history of the Christian people, their religious, civil, cultural, or social deeds. Those responsible must make sure that the use of church archives be facilitated further, that is, not only to the interested who have the right to access, but also to a large range of researchers, without prejudice towards their religious or ideological backgrounds, following the best of church tradition, yet while respecting the appropriate norms of protection offered by the universal law as well as the regulations of the diocesan bishop. Such an attitude of disinterested openness, kind welcome, and competent service must be taken into careful consideration so that the historical memory of the church may be offered to the entire society. That's in that section 4, and it's very well written to use as an argument as to why we need to open our archives. Thus, we have removed that first statement completely from our current policy. The second and third statements are still part of our policy. That second, the search is done only with specific approval of the diocesan chancellor of archivist. And third, the search is made always under the supervision of a staff member by prearranged appointment during regular business hours. You may wonder about that second statement, but once the collection has been opened, the specific approval is there. The prearranged appointment is necessary as one of us needs to be available to put the requested documents to pull the requested documents, and to supervise in the reading room. Our room can sit and seat probably four researchers at a time, and we don't usually want them to overlap with our volunteers who are working on their specific projects. The fourth and final statement of the policy has also been modified. The person conducting the search agrees beforehand in writing that the search is being conducted for genealogical, historical, or other similar processes and is not intended for use in any criminal or civil process. The last part of this statement, not intended for the use in any civil or criminal process, is in opposition to the statement in the circular letter, which addresses an attitude of disinterested openness in the archives. Many of our patrons need certified copies of baptisms, marriages, or burial records for civil purposes, such as Social Security, proof of citizenship, or even with successions. We had one patron who used our documents to prove who her grandparents were in order to qualify for the Italian Olympic team. In this light of openness, we must also not censor the records. I was part of an online discussion just recently, and the question was asked if a burial record containing sensitive information, the person had died at a local insane asylum, should be censored because the granddaughter may not be aware of this information. Restricting information inconsistently is something we as archivists need to guard against, lest we be accused of inequality in access. In our diocese, we have an estimated 70,000 slave documents, primarily baptisms and burials. These records as a whole represent an extraordinary amount of information, some of which provoke strong feelings from our patrons, especially those who are not aware of the fact that their ancestors were enslaved or that someone in their family passed for white. These documents are historical in nature and are open to the public for research. There are other dioceses that do not want to open these records. There is one topic that I would like to bring to the foreground before closing. As a researcher, it is important to know if a collection exists, even if that collection is closed for whatever reason, whether it be confidential material or unprocessed material, etc. If the researcher is aware that there is a collection that was inaccessible, it adds to the research and even the outcome of that research. By calling attention to the fact, the next generation of researchers may be able to access it and continue forward. Without knowing that the collection exists, a disservice is done to the researcher. Let the researcher know that the collection is there, but it is unavailable for whatever that reason may be. So here is the current policy to the access of the historical records of the Diocese of Baton Rouge. Certain archival records of the Diocese of Baton Rouge are of a merely historical nature. These include especially older baptismal, matrimonial, and death records. Access to the historical archives is available to the general public under the following conditions. There's no number one. Persons wishing to conduct a search of the diocese historical archives personally may do so, provided, one, the search is done only with the specific approval of the diocesan chancellor or archivist. Two, the search is made always under the supervision of a staff member by prearranged appointment during regular business hours. And three, persons conducting the search agrees to and signs the policies and procedures statement of the archives. Persons wishing to have archives staff make a search of the diocesan historical archives will make a request in writing to the archives. Certain fees may apply. Please check with the archives staff for the fee schedule. One note is warranted regarding personal searches of the historical archives. As many of the earlier records are in French, Spanish, and or Latin, persons lacking a working knowledge of these languages are advised to rely on the services of the archives staff in their research. In closing, I hope that the changes in our current policy convey that spirit of an attitude of disinterested openness, kind welcome, and competent service so that the historical memory of the church is offered to the entire society.
Just said, and now for something completely different. I'm with a Jewish. Y'all still hear me? Yes. Okay. I'm with the Jewish Historical Society of Metro West, which, when I try and explain it to other people, I say it's kind of like a diocese, but yet not, because well, there isn't such a thing. What I'm going to talk about today is access to Jewish records on the local level. And I'm going to try and explain how it all works, because it's a little bit different than you might find in other faiths. The what that they are looking for is the same in terms of the records of historical, legal, financial, also sacramental value. The where is quite different, and also the how much in terms of what made it into the archives. And to start at the beginning is with what used to be called the UJA, United Jewish Appeal, and is now the UJC, United Jewish Communities. And there's two layers of that. There's the national, and then there's local UJCs. My historical society is an agency of a local UJC. So I technically work for a social service agency. Okay. And the national records for the UJC, they are held at the American Jewish Historical Society. Local UJC records can be nearly anywhere. I happen to have my Federation records. You can also call them the Federation on the local level. I happen to have the Federation records, but they can also end up in state and local historical societies and college and university collections, as I discovered. And if you're looking for Federation records, a good place to start is the American Jewish Historical Society on their Other Historical Societies page. They have a list of all the state by state. If your state has a Jewish Historical Society, it's probably on there. And you can start there, start looking. And if you can't find your state or they don't know what you're talking about, go to the National UJC page and look up your federation and call them and ask, where are the records? Okay, now, a local federation, as I was saying, is a little bit like a diocese. In the sense that it provides community relations, fundraising, and governance and guidance for social service agencies. A federation supports agencies and provides those services in a limited geographic area. My area is Morris, Essex, Sussex, and a chunk of northern Union counties of New Jersey. It includes Newark. And it has, as the Jewish community has moved, the Federation has moved with it. So we started out in Newark, and now we're in Whippany. And also, Federation will provide services outside of its region, in Israel, for example, and we have programs in the former Soviet Union. And on the local level, Federation provides leadership in political and social activism discussions, or else there will be departments within the Federation that do that, or within agencies supported by the Federation that will do that. They also raise money, which then is then distributed to agencies and to other entities within the community, such as synagogue programs. Not operating support for the synagogues, but if the nursery school needs money, the Federation may give it to you. Now, it is different. Federation is different from a diocese in that it provides services without regard to denomination. Does not dictate religious practice, and does not collect or maintain sacramental or general synagogue records, and I covered that bit already. Okay, and it does not, most importantly, does not make decisions in the opening and closing of synagogues or the movement of rabbis. All of that is left to the congregation. Although you can find in Federation records, you can find information about synagogues. It will mostly be synagogue interaction with the Federation in terms of fundraising. So if you can't find any information about the synagogue generated by the synagogue, there may be reference to it scattered through the Federation records. So if you're a researcher and you're looking for a synagogue and it's gone, so you can check in the Federation records and see if there's any newspaper clippings or photographs or something from a fundraising event. Okay. All right, the next challenge is synagogue records. And synagogues are founded by the people for the people, and the people decide how the records are kept. And you may have a congregation that's really devoted and committed to history and archives, and when the time comes, you'll be presented with 16 boxes of neatly organized materials, although they may have spent some time in someone's basement. Or you may have a congregation that doesn't care, and whoever came in threw out 40 years' worth of records and started over. And they may have thrown them out into your archives, or they may have thrown them into the trash, or they may have taken them lovingly over to a college or university or seminary archives, and that's kind of the way it is. Okay. The other thing to know is if a synagogue closes or merges, two synagogues merge, the records don't go to the Federation. They stay with the synagogue, or they don't, depending. I can think of at least three collections I've processed at this point that I have found the records of an earlier synagogue lurking in the new one. And so that's kind of new and different, too. So you're like, oh, look, that's different. I wasn't expecting you. And they can be things that date from the start of the merged synagogue. They just got absorbed as they came together. Okay, so all other sources of records within a Jewish community are there what I think of as community institutions, sick benefits societies, fraternal lodges, and burial societies, which you may hear referred to as Chevra Kadisha. And these are things that some of them have national organizations like B'nai B'rith or Hadassah, and those organizations do keep national archives, but the local ones may end up in local archives. So I have B'nai B'rith records on my shelves from local lodges. And I also have the Sick Benefit Society, also known as KUVs. I have those too. Okay, so if our intrepid researcher has tracked down the records that they are looking for, the next challenge is how much made it into the archives. And Federation records, let's see, when we started collecting, which was in 1990, one of our board members was very well connected in the community, and he went out and asked the agencies for their records. And as a result, people can come to our reading table, it's not really a reading room, and they can research the development of family services and child services starting in 1861 with the Hebrew Benevolent Orphan Asylum Society that eventually merged with three other things to become what is now the Jewish Family Service. They can also consult the records of the UJC Community Relations Committee and learn about how the Jewish community dealt with the growing unrest in Newark in the 60s, and also the resettlement of immigrants over the years from displaced persons arriving after World War II to the Russians who came in the 70s and 80s. And in terms of the synagogues, the collections we have also been the result of people going out and asking. Mostly our curator and outreach director has gone out. And so we have some collections that go back to 1860 or 100-year-old synagogues, and some of them will have just a wealth of information. They'll have constitution and bylaws, lists of boards and trustees, women's, all kinds of minutes, and clubs and photographs and scrapbooks, and it's wonderful, and you can have the same. The next collection over can be a synagogue, can be the same age, and you have scrapbooks and pictures. And it's because it really depends on what was put aside and who gave it to you and how much they cared. Now, the one thing that you may not find in synagogue collections is going to be what I think of as life cycle documents, such as certificates for bar or bat mitzvahs or wedding or marriage contracts. Those things go to the families. So if you're looking for those, you need to look in manuscripts and personal papers. What you will find is references to the event happening, like a list of people who were confirmed or who are at a bar and bat mitzvah, or who, you'll find it in synagogue bulletins if there are synagogue bulletins. But you won't necessarily find the certificate. And the other thing that can be in synagogue records is rabbis and cantors, sermons and notes, although those things may end up back at a seminary, depending on if the person was prominent or infamous or famous. Just famous will do. I have some rabbi papers that have, over the years, gotten separated from the original synagogue, so I'm in the process of trying to realign them with their synagogue, so they're all together in one place. And that's it. It kind of depends. I think that what I would tell researchers is don't be afraid to be intrepid and to keep digging and to try avenues that might seem a little silly at first, because you never know where you're going to find things.
Good afternoon. Today I am pleased to present what I call the Marquette model on angling for access, which I believe can be useful for providing better bibliographic access for some subsets of religious records. In so doing, I will discuss two subject-based record survey projects conducted by Marquette University. One of which happened prior to and one since the advent of online archival description. During the past 2 years, I have directed a 14-state survey of Catholic records in the West about American Indians and Eskimos, which will culminate soon in an online record guide that will join a comparable Midwest guide already online. Together, both guides provide a useful model for archival survey projects by other institutions, and in my presentation, I will draw upon both projects and related experiences with Catholic and Native American records. From the 1930s through the 1980s, historians and archivists developed record surveys using questionnaires about holdings and on-site inspection of records to improve archival administration and to compile guides to aid researchers. In 1977, the Society of American Archivists recognized the prevalence of these practices by publishing a how-to manual within the basic manual series. John Fleckner, now archivist of the Smithsonian's National Museum of American History, authored this book, which was titled Archives and Manuscripts Surveys. Just this year, or just the year before in recognition of historians' growing interest in studying American Indians and Eskimos, Marquette had compiled a preliminary national survey of Catholic records about Native Americans and subsequently used the Fleckner Manual to develop comprehensive regional surveys of Catholic records about American Indians in the Midwest and Western states. Meanwhile, as interest in the web grew, interest in surveys declined. Nonetheless, I and a few other archivists who document minority populations believe that subject-based archival surveys and guides remain useful tools for identifying offline records about small and relatively obscure populations. Prior to the web, from 1980 to 1984, Marquette's staff conducted its comprehensive Midwest survey with a grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities. This project culminated in publication of the first edition to Guide to Catholic Indian Mission and School Records in Midwest Repositories by Philip Banton and Mark Thiel, which included 277 repository entries to approximately 1,000 cubic feet of targeted records in 12 Midwestern states, including Oklahoma. I should note that when we defined repositories for the purposes of our guides, we included more than what most people think of as just repositories. These are both repositories and other institutions where records originated and were still being held at, such as many parishes and schools typically hold their non-current records. Could be 50, 75 years after the creation of the record before they're transferred to, say, diocesan archives or other repositories. It followed standard archival practice for a printed subject-based guide, as described by Fleckner, and subsequently was nominated for the Sister M. Claude Lane Award and acclaimed an outstanding achievement at the 1992 annual meeting of the Association of Catholic Diocesan Archivists. In the guide, holding descriptions were derived from data acquired by surveying 833 prospective institutions through a mailed questionnaire and on-site inspection of 160 selected institutions. Holdings ranged in size from at least one-tenth of a cubic foot at several repositories to Marquette University, where we have the Bureau of Catholic Indian Mission Records, a collection with a national scope based here in Washington, D.C., and other collections totaling approximately 800 cubic feet from the 1840s to the present, with a mean average of approximately 3 cubic feet. In addition, Marquette invented an innovative feature, a history note for the entries of Catholic institutions with direct involvement with Native Americans, institutions such as Catholic parishes, missions, and schools, and diocesan and religious congregations. Early on, we learned firsthand the importance of researching institutional histories as roadmaps to finding targeted records in the custody of church institutions. Consequently, the history notes were deemed essential to illuminating the content of the surveyed records and confirm their provenance and disposition because of the complex and fluid nature of both the Catholic administrative system and the Native American constituencies they served. We researched the histories through annual listings in church directories, such as the official Catholic directory, with cross-checking against local and institutional histories where available. The notes chronicle the intertwined institutional genealogies and relationships of the various organizations and constituencies, along with other events that affected the creation, disposition, and content of the records. The histories enhance understanding of the identity, the content, and location of records, and alleviate confusion in identity between various religious and ethnic groups. Those for diocesan and religious congregation entries are limited to brief annotations identifying the principal targeted institutions administered and staffed, whereas those for parish, mission, and school entries are expanded to include all known notable events at the institution that affected record provenance, such as name and service dates for church organizations and key individuals that administered and or staffed the institutions, dates when satellite facilities in outlying communities were attended from the primary institution, names of the ethnic groups served, the dates of unintended calamities, tornadoes, hurricanes, whatever, that affected operations and record retention or destruction by these events, and institutional name changes. From 2003 to early 2004, Marquette staff revised and reformatted a second edition to the Midwest Guide, which we published online under the new name of Guide to Catholic Native American Records in Midwest Repositories. With adjustments made for a web-based publication, this edition included updated contact information for the previous entries, additional entries for new and previously omitted institutions, the use of Library of Congress subject headings for Native and Catholic groups, and several appendices and online links that were added to aid the user. Some things that were not added were such as notes on restrictions to records beyond a general statement that some restrictions apply. Reason being is we feel that we're going to be updating these guides on an infrequent basis, and information that may change prior to when we get around to updating the guide may make a statement outdated, and so we're trying to keep our information as current for as long as possible. Then in 2004, Marquette received an $83,000 matching grant from the National Historical Publications and Records Commission to conduct a comprehensive survey of Catholic records in the West about American Indians and Eskimos. However, we had to first resolve a conflict regarding funding the research for the administrative histories. NHPRC guidelines prohibited the awarding of funds for historic research, and Marquette, backed with a support letter from John Fleckner, deemed the research essential for locating many of the records targeted by the survey. But soon we achieved a compromise by agreeing to finance the histories solely from Marquette's matching funds and not the NHPRC funding. During this era of the web, from the mid-2004 to the present, Marquette has conducted this survey with a staff of 2.5 full-time equivalents, and tentatively, the project will be completed by September 15th, with the online publication of Guide to Catholic Native American Records in Western Repositories. The guide will include 545 repository entries to over 2,200 cubic feet of records in 14 states, including Alaska, Texas, and yes, even Hawaii. From oral histories, we have learned that American Indian Catholics, now estimated at about 500, began living in Honolulu since the back in the early 19th century. These are primarily people from tribes with traditions of fishing, where they had individuals from these tribes, primarily the western coast, Oregon, Washington State, who, working like for companies such as Hudson Bay Company, moved to Honolulu to work in the fishing industry. Like the Midwest survey, the Western Project has followed standard archival practice and its guide will include the same features as the related Midwest guide. Using mailed questionnaires in four repository-specific versions, that is, we had one version for parishes and schools, another version for our diocesan archives, another version for public repositories, because there were certain terms that were, although they may be fundamentally the same, there was a different sort of professional jargon that was being used by each of these groups, and so we wanted to make sure that our questions were being fully understood. Project staff surveyed 1,800 prospects identified from print directories and online websites. By phone and email, staff followed up with questions to non-compliant repositories and other repositories for which clarification or more information was needed. Then, at approximately 200 selected repositories, the project director, who was me, I inspected targeted records and finding aids to acquire additional information. That is, you know, driving from Arizona to Alaska and all points in between. As before, this compiled data provided the basis for the holdings descriptions in the repository entries. Ultimately, we determined that 387 Catholic institutions held about 1,700 cubic feet of records, or about 74% of the total that we uncovered, and that 158 non-Catholic, that is public, Native American, mainline Protestant, and Latter-day Saint repositories, held an additional 603 cubic feet, or 26% of the total. Most records in Catholic custody were original administrative records, and in some cases, in Catholic universities, you would find ethnographic records by missionaries who, say, were also de facto ethnologists, as well as in other repositories, public repositories, you would find a lot of unofficial records, such as oral histories, photograph collections, private papers, and microfilm copies of institutional Catholic records. Holdings ranged in size from at least one-tenth of a cubic foot at several repositories to the Jesuits' Oregon Province Archives at Gonzaga University, Spokane, Washington, which has approximately 800 cubic feet from the 1840s to the present. In conducting these surveys, we encountered a number of problems, and I would like to identify a few examples. No doubt, with the development of online repository-based archival descriptions, web portals, and Google, many archivists and researchers believe that soon this new system will provide for most researchers navigational needs in finding the records that they need. But in reality, as many of us know, that web-based solutions are not as yet within the grasp of many, and that bibliographic online descriptions will be a reality in the distant future at best. In most church-affiliated repositories, the necessary financial resources to create online descriptions simply, they're not there. And there are other instances where we do find online descriptions, but the metadata is lacking. There are, particularly for secondary topics within the records, you find that the information provided is vague or simply incomplete. You can have collections that they might by chance mention that it's about from a particular church, but there may be no mention of the fact that the parishioners served may belong to a certain particular ethnic group, that this is a definite ethnic parish. Consequently, repositories with the wherewithal and the motivation for outreach, I feel have an enormous opportunity to distinguish themselves, and I believe that the Marquette projects hold promise as an effective model. Ambiguous religious and ethnic descriptions appear most often in public repositories and include issues such as incomplete names for local missions, parishes, and schools. One that's very common, that I very commonly have seen, is like, say, a name, St. Michael's, in records, like at the National Archives branch, for example, the one in Denver. Also at many state historical societies, you'll find something similar. It'll simply say, like, St. Michael's Church. Well, is it a Catholic church? Is it an Orthodox? Is it Episcopalian, whatever? This simply is not stated, and so you have to do some digging to find out. And sometimes, you know, that could take a lot of research beyond looking at the records that are at that institution. Sometimes unique gems with limited identification show up in unexpected places. And one photograph that comes to mind was a religious photograph in a non-religious collection that was at a museum at the University of New Mexico. This image was of a totem pole from Alaska dated 1886, and it featured three Native-style carvings vertically, because it was a totem pole, representing the Blessed Trinity. And although there was no written religious and ethnic affiliation given, the fourth carving on the totem pole provided some clues. It was the Romanov family crest, which is what sponsored the Orthodox Church in Alaska. So obviously then the particular native carver adhered to Russian Orthodoxy, or at least that's a reasonable assumption. And their cathedral was based in Sitka, Alaska, and was also within the homeland of the Tlingit Indians. So I think it's quite possible that might be the ethnic affiliation. But again, these are just assumptions, and that's the best someone could do. In church repositories, long intertwined institutional histories, coupled with name changes, repeated use of similar or same names, administrative mergers and divisions, personnel changes, all of these issues can present problems in tracking records and their provenance. For example, at Our Lady of Mount Carmel Church on the Isleta del Sur Reservation near El Paso, Texas, was established in 1683 as a mission to the Tiwa Indian refugees who, with the Spanish, had fled New Mexico following the 1680 Pueblo Revolt in New Mexico. Previously, this church had other names. It was known first as San Antonio de la Isleta Mission and then Corpus Christi Mission before the current name. Which is also used by other missions in California and Oregon. During its history, Our Lady of Mount Carmel came under a succession of diocesan jurisdictions, beginning with the Diocese of Durango, Mexico, then Galveston, Houston, in theory at least, but not practice, finally under the Diocese of Galveston, Houston, and then El Paso today. Also at various times, Franciscans, Jesuits, and conventuals from Sonora, New Mexico, and Indiana administered Our Lady of Mount Carmel, with each of these organizations all having their own archives, as well as the at the parish today, there are substantial holdings of records. Needs for sacramental records for specific family members generates perhaps the greatest demand for church records. Typically, sacramental records originate within the parish as handwritten entries within bound registries. For the first 70 to 100 years, records commonly reside within the parish, and thereafter, oftentimes, diocesan archives take over the custody of sacramental records. Nevertheless, in both instances, navigating the records requires knowing the parish where the record originated from, which isn't always known. Searching then becomes a problem, and in large metropolitan archdioceses such as Los Angeles, it is a problem of major proportion, where each month the Archdiocesan Archives distributes a list of unsuccessful searches within all of its parishes together, and then it distributes this list to all the parishes in the hopes that other parishes not previously contacted might found the unfound records. The Los Angeles Archdiocese will have just a few parish entries within our Western Guide, as it has only a few parishes that have at least a few American Indian parishioners. However, elsewhere, our Midwest and Western Guides hold hundreds of parish entries. And judging from the stream of genealogical inquiries that we get at Marquette University, I'm sure that there's going to be many Native American genealogists who will be accessing these entries. Throughout the United States, Marquette has identified more than 100 Catholic religious congregations that have one or more repositories with records about Native Americans. And among them are several with similar names with potential for identity confusion. For example, 14 congregations of women religious follow the traditions of St. Francis of Assisi. Each maintains one or more separate archives. All have worn similar Franciscan dress, and all are known as Franciscan Sisters or Sisters of St. Francis. To distinguish one from another and find the correct repository, researchers must know a congregation's formal name, such as Hospital Sisters of the Third Order of St. Francis from Springfield, Illinois, the Sisters of St. Francis of Penance and Christian Charity, which has separate provinces and province archives in Stella, Niagara, New York, and Denver, Colorado, and the Poor Sisters of St. Francis Seraph of the Perpetual Adoration, also known as the Sisters of St. Francis of Perpetual Adoration, with separate provinces and province archives in Colorado Springs and Mishawaka, Indiana. And all of these places have records about Native Americans that are thousands of miles, whose homelands are thousands of miles from where the archives are located. And so the average person, well, he really has no idea of where to begin looking. Okay, most of you, when you came in, got a green handout, and a few people did not because we ran out. So I apologize for that. The two key things for the people who have not gotten the handout that you should know is, one, that if you want additional information, you can email me, and my email address is mark@marquette.edu. And I'll things you could ask me for would be copies of the NHPRC application, our final report. We're also going to be having, for people who are don't have regular access to the web, we also have a limited number of print guides available, so you could email me about that as well. And then our primary web address to which you can link to all of our guides is 3dubs.marquette. marquette.edu/library/collections/archives/teaching.html. From there, you will find links to all of our Native Catholic guides. Furthermore, from our experience, there are several advantages that we've identified for these guides. One is public relations. The guides are a great public service. They identify all sorts of obscure and underutilized offline records. They help to identify a particular universe of documentation. The metadata, in the subject-based guides, helps to identify potential records that an institution may see as a potential donor out there. We've had some religious archives, for example, where we've borrowed their Native American-related records. We've microfilmed them for them, or in other cases where some would like us to become their archives. So it can be a source for collection development as well as outreach. We have an applied history program because through the guides we've come up with placement sites for interns. Also, it can be useful to church leaders who you have an obscure minority population that's underserved within the church. You can help church leaders to identify who are these underserved people. And also, for most archivists out there that you're going to be visiting or meeting with a survey questionnaire, most of them find the benefits to the survey to be self-evident, and most people have been extremely helpful. In the hundreds of people that I met and visited with for the guide, I would say really only two people were not really helpful. And in meeting with colleagues of these two individuals, it was readily apparent it had to do with these two persons' personalities, not what I was trying to do. Other limitations are funding. While online subject guides have possibilities that may not be a viable solution for all circumstances, as with so many archival projects, funding opportunities are sparse. Much of the potential financial support is apparently tied to colleges and universities, with supplemental support from foundations, they're going to be very limited. What we've come up with, for the most part, have been matching grants. At Marquette, we've conducted three surveys of Native Catholic records, and all were at least partially grant-funded. The first was funded by a private foundation, which is now defunct. The second was the National Endowment for the Humanities, and the third was the National Historical Publications and Records Commission. However, for the last 2 years in a row now, NHPRC has been under attack from the Bush administration that's been wanting to eliminate them. And due to the federal trust responsibility towards American Indians and Eskimos, NHPRC, and I believe NEH, only fund record surveys pertaining to these Aboriginal American populations. However, funds for Native American projects are underutilized, and so far, if you have a well-planned project, chances are very good that you're going to get the funding that you are seeking. On-site visitation costs are perhaps the most, well, they are obviously the most expensive costs for survey projects, and they are potential budget busters with today's gasoline prices. When planning our Western survey, we priced gasoline at about $2 a gallon, but when we actually hit the field, we are typically paying above $3 a gallon. And when you're driving 100,000 miles, that obviously adds up. Although on-site visits were essential for Marquette's survey, some successful past surveys have been accomplished through mail questionnaire surveys and follow-up telephone calls without field work. So it's possible you might not need this expensive component. Major repositories with professional staff are willing to respond to question surveys. However, for those repositories that now have detailed finding aids, a more efficient approach to a substitute to specific substitute questions, sometimes these can be better. If you Some repositories, they respond more to specific questions tailored just to them rather than a standardized questionnaire. And I'm talking about some of the really big institutions out there. We found that to be better. So from our 30 years of experience with surveys, we believe that surveys can be a viable option, although, like I said, there are limitations, but it definitely should be something that you ought to consider. And like everyone else here, I'd be happy to answer any whatever questions you might have. Thank you.
Well, I'd like to thank all of the speakers, and the three very different presentations sort of illuminated sort of other aspects of access, from not only providing better access to existing collections, but identifying hitherto unknown materials for research. So we have a few minutes left. I'd like to open up the floor to any questions. If you would speak loudly, because we're supposed to repeat the question. This session is being recorded, so if any of you don't want to be heard, but otherwise, would you speak up?
Yeah. Okay, I'm going to repeat the question for everyone's benefit, which was about missionary families, and do those records exist, and if so, how do we get to them? Okay, and can current missionary families deposit their records in your archives?
In our diocese, we don't actually have missionary families that are going out and working like a Protestant group would have, but we have funded over. It's not there anymore, but there was the Apollonia mission in South America somewhere, and we have all of the records from the priest of what was going there and coming back. I believe that the Sacramento registers and all of that stayed down there because that would be with the people and would stay them, but the paperwork of what we were funding, we have several boxes of that material in our collection.
Well, at Marquette, we do have missionary records of missionaries, but not missionary families, simply because most Catholic missionaries have been celibate. Certainly, in visiting public repositories and examining religious records, missionary records that pertain to American Indians, I certainly encountered, papers of missionary families. In some instances, since I was looking at a Catholic perspective, some of these missionaries, particularly in the 19th century, where there was contentious relationships with Catholic missionaries, I mean, these people had well-known positions about Catholic missionaries. There was an adversarial relationship, and so that was something that I was interested in documenting. But I mean, state historical societies do have, oftentimes have missionary family papers. So that could be certainly one place for a person to investigate if you're looking for a home for such papers. Right.
Any further questions?
Sure.
Yes. Loretta asked me if I could reference the document from the Pontifical Commission. Is that the one? Okay. Yes, it's dated February 2nd, 1997. It was actually written by, or it's signed anyway, by Francesco Marchisano. It's Marchisano. And the letter is entitled, it comes in a book form, The Pastoral Function of Church Archives. And it was published by the Vatican City and by the Pontifical Commission for the Cultural Heritage of the Church. And it's February 2nd, 1997. Do you know where that's available? I mean, we just have it in our office.
I don't. I know we have a few copies of them, but I don't know where it's widely available.
That particular letter by Archbishop Marchesano was distributed to all dioceses worldwide in different language, depending upon your local language. I have a copy of it because, you know, there are a number of dioceses out there for where there are some access problems. I've been considering scanning it and putting it on our website as one of our reference documents that go with our guides because I hear so many stories of access problems that really shouldn't be there.
Anything else? Further questions? Yes.
Just to
follow up on that. Yeah, exactly. I know there are other denominational archives that do have missionary families and do have records. The Archdiocese of Boston has records from the Society of St. James the Apostle, which is a missionary society established by Cardinal Cushing in the late 1950s that works in South America. And we have just recently acquired the records from that organization, and we'll be constantly adding to that. But again, that's a Catholic organization, so they're not missionary families, but it's an extensive body of records.
All right, I'm just saying this again so that it's on the record. The Congregationalist Archives in Honolulu has records of missionary families, and you can find... Wyatt Mission Children's Society. All right, and they have several generations of personal and business papers and mission reports and all kinds of wonderful things. So if you're looking for it, that's where it is. And you can also, if you're interested, research the adversarial relationship between the Catholic missionaries and the Congregationalists.
Any further questions?
And just to throw my oar in here, we don't have missionaries. but the Chabad is growing nationally and internationally, and we do have some records from Chabad organizations. And as I'm sitting here listening to this, I'm thinking, you know, I should make sure that as those, because they move in to the area and they establish a congregation, that I should make sure that somewhere down the line someone gets those records from them.
Anything else? Well, thank you all, and thank our speakers, please.